Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's Monday, November 14th, 2022, live to be rebroadcast Wednesday, November 16th, 2022 on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza will be back in a few because we're getting new countertops. Oh boy. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let me know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcasts at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you are having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So what I wanted to talk about today, first, before I get into today's topic, let's just look at the fact that all of a sudden it's really cold. A week ago today, it was in the 70s. And today, last night, it got down into the 20s. And today, it's, I don't even know if it's going to hit 50 today. So we're getting into that cold time of year. And we're not going to see 50 all week, as far as I know. And we may not even see 40 on at least one of the days this weekend. And they're predicting a little bit of snow tomorrow night. Oh my goodness, it's at least some mixed precipitation that is going to precipitate on Wednesday, and some of it might be frozen probably overnight. And in fact, in the more northerly parts of Connecticut, in the cold part, Norfolk, and they are possibly going to get a dusting, like an inch or two. Incredible, right? It's that time of year. And that's appropriate for this time of year. Sometimes in November it snows, and that's okay. In fact, occasionally it snows in October. But it's that time of year, time to be cozy. Last night, Ron made this beautiful soup. It had bone broth in it, and it had, it was a squash soup with ginger and coconut milk and bone broth, and it was just amazing. It was just really nice and soothing to have a terrific soup. So let me get to what I wanted to talk about today. This time of year, you might find that you're starting to crave food a little bit more. And of course, we're getting into the eating season. We've just passed the first eating benchmark, which was Halloween, where you get all that great candy. And now you may still have extra candy around. I actually went to the store yesterday, and of course, it's not even Thanksgiving, and they have the Christmas candy out. And I like to put some select things in our stockings. And so it was already time to start getting that stuff. So there's goodies around all year, and people like to bake this time of year, both because it makes nice gifts. It's also because it's a way to gather around something that's good to eat. And you're craving carbs this time of year. You're craving something sweet. You're craving something hearty, and you're craving more food. And I'm just going to put out there, I think it's normal to crave a bit more food when it gets cold. And naturally, you want to eat more because you want to be a little bit warmer. It makes you feel warmer when you're metabolizing, when you've got food on, and certainly when you have a little more fat on. And I've had people complain, you know, my patients complain that it's really hard to get into a habit of good, healthy eating and exercise. And when you're dragging yourself out of that prolonged cold bit of the winter into the spring, and of course Connecticut spring is kind of up and down until it gets consistently warm. Finally, May, June, you get into a consistent program. Maybe you're exercising, you're eating a little bit better, and you're really in the swing of it by August. And then, you know, August, September, the temperature starts to drop, and then it gets cold again, and then it breaks you out of your routine. When you live in a temperate climate like this, it makes it really difficult to maintain routine because the weather here is very dynamic, and it's dramatically dynamic. It can be very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. So you're forced to have to change it up. And anybody who does well with routine doesn't do as well. It's very interesting, right? That if you are a person who thrives on routine, you can't help but have your routine be broken by the cycles of the weather in this season. Some people do well with it. Some people manage to ebb and flow. And, you know, I have things that I do indoors. I have things that I do outdoors. And, you know, I, as much as I respond to the changing of the seasons, I do have a method that I use to help keep myself on track. And that's that I take it one day at a time. So if I look at the weather, you know, last week, the weather was going to be 70 degrees. So I said, okay, I'm going to make time. I'm going to clear my day and I'm going to get on my bike because that's probably the last day I can wear short sleeves. So I did that. And now that I see it's going to be really cold, I fortunately have indoor things that I can do. I have an indoor bike trainer that I can use, an indoor bike program that I can use. And I do yoga. I do my yoga indoors and outdoors, depending on the temperature and depending on how dark it is when I want to do the yoga. I mean, it became difficult to do yoga outside if I wanted to do it past 5 o'clock because the sun is now setting at close to 4:30. So we're losing minutes rapidly. Anyway, so if you respond to the days with whatever it is going on in that day, whatever the conditions are, wherever you are, you're going to be more successful. If you have a plan, if you look at the outlook of the week, and if your exercise habits are based on what the weather is doing, you can kind of look out over the week and think, all right, it's going to be raining on this day, so I'm going to plan to work out indoors on this day. On Thursday, it's going to be sunny, and though it's going to be cold, it might be nice to go out for a walk. I'll bundle out and get outside. Or maybe I just can't, even it's just too cold, I'm going to do everything indoors. And you can plan it out that way. And get into a routine. There are some people who get into a routine and because they don't want to break their routine, they only exercise indoors. And I wouldn't like to do that personally because I do like to be outside, but that is a valid strategy. If you are really a person who likes routine and you can, and you, exercise is something that's hard for you to get into, If you commit to exercising indoors and that's the only way that you exercise, you're going to be successful most of the year because unless there's a power outage or you're away from your exercise location, you're going to be able to exercise. And then if you can figure out how to exercise indoors while you're traveling, then you'll just be able to do it anywhere because you don't always want to be outside. But you can always be indoors. So if you use that, if you are very much a routine person, even if it's gorgeous and sunny out, if you do better with routine going to that same gym every time or that same gym downstairs in your house every single time, then do that. I think that's fine. So if you're having difficulty with the change of the season, it's okay. I think a lot of people do. Ron and I are noticing that we're wanting to sleep more. We're wanting to rest more. I'm finding that I'm not as motivated to do a lot of things that I'm instead wanting to, like when I have my downtime, I want to rest. I just want to read books and drink a cup of tea and snuggle up in bed. And that's going to keep happening. That's going to be like that for the rest of November into December. And it's probably not going to change until the light starts coming back. And let me remind you again, we are losing light at either end of the day right now. And we're going to stop losing light in 3 weeks at the end of the day. So the sunset is going to bottom out at about 4:18, 4:20 p.m. And it's going to stay there for a week, starting on December 7th. And then on December 15th, we're going to start gaining minutes at the end of the day. Even though we're going to continue to lose minutes in the morning, we're going to start gaining minutes at the end of the day. So it's going to start getting lighter on December 15th. By Christmas, we will have gained back maybe 5 minutes, five or 10 minutes. Certainly by New Year's, the sun is now setting at 4:30, about 4:30 again. No, 4:30, right? It's still awfully early because it's setting pretty early right now. It's amazing. And of course the sunset doesn't mean that there's no light. It just means the moment when the sun drops below the horizon, there's still some dusk. And the dusk is that period of time between when the sun drops below the horizon and last light. But it's dark, you know, the shadows are very long. I noticed that if I'm riding my bike at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the shadows are very long, even though it's still sunny out and there's sunshine. The shadows are long, but the sun is bright coming through the trees that have no leaves on them. So there's that. That's one thing that you do get, even though the leaves are down. That's kind of sad. When there is sun, it's very bright because there's no leaves for blocking the sunlight. So what sunlight you have, you get to experience. All right. So as I said, if routine is difficult for you, especially in terms of exercise, and you find that maintaining routine makes it so that you have to only exercise indoors, even if it's all year, then do that. It's fine. Ron teaches a spin class that he teaches all year round that starts at 5:45 a.m. and it's indoors and it is all year round. And those people come all year. Are there people who don't come to your spin class at certain times of year?
For some reason, the extreme spin class tends to draw in January, tends to draw some more outdoor cyclists in
because right.
at that point it's January. So therefore
it's very hard to ride your bike outside.
But, I have different people that come to different classes, but yep.
But your 5:45 a.m. class, it's the same people all year.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it sure is. Whether it's nice out or not, and whether they ride outside or not.
Right.
Because a number of them ride outside also.
Yes. So it's about routine.
It is all about routine.
And that's what I've been saying, that one of the things that's difficult about living in Connecticut is the dynamic nature of the weather here, that the weather, you know, in July, it's really hot, and in January, it's really cold. And if you're a person who thrives on routine, it's very hard to create a routine because of the change in the weather and the change in the light and how dynamic it is. And I've been, you know, you and I have been sleeping more and finding that we're more tired. And, you know, we have to just remember that this happens every year. You know, in November, our energy kind of goes.
Yep, it's all true.
And the other thing was when I lived in Canada, the first year I lived in Canada was 1995. And I lived in Newfoundland, and they have Thanksgiving on October 14th. So, October 14th, the second Monday in October is their Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving is not a big deal in Canada like it is in the United States. So that first year, I didn't go home for Thanksgiving, and there was no Thanksgiving. I just worked on Thanksgiving Day and worked the day after, and it was like any other day. And it made me nuts. And I realized that that Thanksgiving break is really necessary, that I was so used to it, because you're in this transition from the warmer months and the lighter months into the cooler months. And when you get into November, your energy is really starting to, you're really starting to fight with, I have to keep moving and I'm tired. And so that Thanksgiving break is really useful. It's really helpful because it gives you a reset. And when I didn't have it, it really upset me. And, you know, they're used to it in Canada, and it's darker and colder up there. But I was so used to having the Thanksgiving break that it really, really upset me not to have it. So I said never again. And from that point on, while I was still living in Canada, I came home every year. My birthday present was a plane ticket. And I would come home, and I would have Thanksgiving with them. And that was kind of fun. It was really cool that I was able to do that. And then I never missed Thanksgiving again. And I don't miss Thanksgiving anymore. Now Thanksgiving starts with the Manchester Road Race. That's
Absolutely.
Just what it is. Yeah.
As so, it should.
Yes. So we'll be doing that this year. We'll see how I'll dress up. Probably a pirate. I don't know. All right. So what I wanted to talk about today was I started with people are, you know, having energy issues, craving more food. The big thing that people tend to crave is starches and sugars this time of year. So there's a great question. Should you reduce your sugar intake? That's a great question.
It is a great question.
So, if you're talking about health and nothing else, refined added sugars, you shouldn't eat them. You know, if you're talking only about your physical well-being, your physical health. You have to look back to see what paleo people ate. And did Paleolithic people eat refined sugar? No, they didn't, because there wasn't any. The only sweet they ate came in the form, if there was a sweet part of the animal, that they ate that. And if they could find honey, they ate that. There was no maple syrup because they weren't making it. But honey, if they could get to honey and they could get it, if they have the bravery to get it out of the beehive, they could get honey. And they ate fruit, and that's all they ate. That was sweet. So if you want to look to how to be absolutely healthy and pristine, you have to look to that. And that's the way it is. Hmm. So the thing is, if you say don't ever eat sugar again, a lot of people are going to freak. And why is that? Why? And I'm going to put out there, sugar is fun.
And we were brought up on it.
That's true.
We were fed from the food industry. The food industry pumped lots of sugar into
us. Okay, so that's another issue. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to the sugar is fun part. Mm. If you completely avoid it, you may not be happy. And, you know, a lot of diets that are very restrictive, people are not successful on because there are foods that they love that they can't eat. And so when you're extremely restrictive on a diet, people tend not to stay with it. I have, and I don't know if I have very few people who stick with a diet that is very far off from what the standard American diet is, who stay with it. There are some people who do. There are people who do the ketogenic diet. They're, you know, almost, I would say, religious ketogenic people who they go on the keto diet where they're eating fat and meat and little vegetable matter and maybe a little bit of fruit, but they're, you know, they're keeping their ketones up and their sugar's very low, and they're very successful and they feel wonderful doing it and they stay with it. Most people who go on that diet don't stay with it. And that's because it's not right for most people. Most people can't sustain it because after a while, either they get bored or they just don't feel good on it. And I'm one of those people that I did not feel good on it. When I went ketogenic, my body just couldn't handle having my blood sugar that low. So if you have a body that can manage some level of starch and sugar, then you should eat some starch and sugar. There are people who do absolutely wonderfully on the ketogenic diet. People get bored, and people don't. The problem with eating is that people in our culture don't just eat to sustain themselves. And that's a sad thing when you think about the fact that there are people who are food insecure in this world and who don't know how and when they're going to get their next meal. But many people in this culture, even if you go to a food pantry, there's not going to just be vegetables and meat at a food pantry. There's treats at food pantries too. So because we recognize that people don't just eat to sustain themselves, they eat for pleasure. That's why there are whole, you know, TV networks based around food. There are cookbooks around food. They're not so that you can have your basic meat and root vegetables and other vegetables and fruit and have them be tasteless. No, people are fascinated with food. There's a whole cooking industry. There's a whole chef industry. There are competitions for every kind of food out there, and people have fun eating it, and people eat for celebration. And I think that if there are physicians out there who try to get their patients just to eat to live and not to live to eat, they're not going to be successful. Most people eat for celebration as well as to sustain themselves. And most people eat for pleasure. They like to eat things that taste good. They like to eat things that they enjoy. And if you only have people eating for sustenance, they're not going to be happy. And nobody's going to be happy. I mean, even people who are food insecure, people who are food insecure, if you get care for them and get them to food pantries and get them food they need, you don't just give them, like I said, meat and vegetables. You give them something. You give them treats too. So why is sugar fun? It tastes good. It lights up the dopamine in your brain. Your body can use it very immediately for fuel. And unfortunately, if you eat too much of it, because it's so easy to use for fuel, if you eat too much of it, you're going to store some of it as fat, and your body is not very motivated to go after your fat store. So the more sugar you eat, the more fat you're going to store. If you can find that sweet spot, if you're at a weight that you like and you can find an amount of sugar that works for you, that doesn't make you gain weight, then great. You're really not supposed to eat. Most people eat around 17 teaspoons of added sugar a day, and it's supposed to be, for men and women, supposed to be more like in the single digits. And so that's added sugar, so they're not talking necessarily about fruit. Now, if you're eating 18 apples a day, that's probably not good for you. But if you're eating a couple of servings of fruit in a day, and depending on you and your diet and your tolerance, that's probably fine, depending on what it is. So I'm saying that for most people, they're going to find ways to eat something sweet at whether or not they're losing weight or not. If they're in a place where they're eating too much sugar, then they're going to eat too much. And if they're on a plan where they want to improve their health, they're going to find a way to eat something sweet. And if you look at some of these ketogenic products, there are products that you can buy that have sugar alcohols in them. Why? Because they expect that people on ketogenic diets are still going to want the taste of sweet. They are not going to just want their meat and vegetables. So they make these great keto bars that are chocolate. They have chocolate in them and they have sugar alcohols. So people crave the taste of sweet. And then there's the other piece that in Chinese medicine, there are a number of tastes and you're supposed to taste all of them. And in the course of a day, for your health, you're supposed to taste every single one of them because they're balancing to all of your meridians. And the tastes are the different tastes of the different organ systems. I don't know if I can list them all off, but one of them is sweet, one of them is bitter, one of them is burnt, one of them is salty, one of them is sour. And all of those tastes are important to your health. And they all are associated with different organ systems and meridians, and they are all and they all stimulate different parts of your health. So if you had no sweet ever at all, that's not necessarily good for you. And as I said, the Paleolithic people would look for things in nature that were sweet because they knew they were good to eat. If something was excessively bitter or tasted like a chemical, they would not necessarily eat it. But if it tasted like a ripe blueberry, they were going to go ahead and eat it. Sugar is a signal that this thing is okay to eat. Spoiled is a signal that this thing is not okay to eat. So there you go. So part of the deal with sugar is that sugar is fun. The other piece of sugar is fun is that one thing I deal with, I would say with myself and also with other people in my practice, is that people are excessively busy and people don't always get the pleasure that they want. If they're working very hard, if you have a person who's working, who has a commute, who has children, who's up at dawn, maybe fits a workout in, maybe doesn't, but is taking care of children and is also working and has to take care of those children. And you get meals on the table, get shopping done, get all kinds of tasks done. They don't necessarily have time to sit down and have leisure. So what are things that give us pleasure? Things that give us pleasure are things that that allow us to rest, that allow us to enjoy reading a book for pleasure, watching TV for pleasure, you know, just watching just something fun on the TV, you know, getting a massage, getting a bath, hanging out with your friends, doing things where you get a break from your day. And if you are go, go, go all day and you don't get a lot of breaks during the day, then you may be feeling that there's a lack of sweetness, a lack of pleasure in your life. And one thing that's easy to do is to eat something. So you can take a minute or two and eat some chocolate, and then you get a little bit of pleasure. You get a little bit of a jolt of serotonin and dopamine. You get that small amount of pleasure in your day because you don't have time to do the yoga. You don't have time to do the meditation. You don't have time to sit and talk with your friends because your day is nonstop. So that's another reason why people eat sweet stuff. It's an immediate pleasure and it's something that you can do quickly. It doesn't have to take up a lot of time in your day. So that's one of the pieces about sugar that I may sound like I'm a sugar advocate. I'm not necessarily. I'm just saying that if you try to make yourself never eat it again, you may not be successful. And if you are a practitioner and you try to tell your patients not to eat it ever again, you may not be successful. I'm just putting that out there.
Would you say that sugar is as addictive as nicotine?
And that is the next point. Sugar is addictive. One of the points we're going to discuss, I'm not saying that sugar is addictive. I'm saying this is a point for discussion. Is it addictive? Is it as addictive as nicotine? I'm going to go with no, because nicotine is one of the most addictive substances we know. It may be the most addictive chemical that we know. It is more addictive than heroin. It is more addictive than opiates.
Really?
Yes. Nicotine is extremely addictive. That's why people have a really difficult time quitting smoking.
Yeah.
And they keep quitting. Wow. And trying, because you have nicotinic and muscarinic receptors in so many different systems in your body, and your body gets into an equilibrium with the nicotine, and it's very hard to withdraw it because you have very unpleasant neurological symptoms when you're withdrawing it from it. Now, mind you, you can get withdrawal when you are withdrawing from sugar, if you suddenly drop your sugar intake. Is it as addictive as nicotine? I don't think so because, well, I mean, it also depends on the person. Sugar is addictive. When you talk about a substance being addictive, you're talking about a physical dependency on it. And are we necessarily physically dependent on sugar? Now, there are those who say there is no carbohydrate that we must eat because carbohydrate isn't necessarily an essential substance. We can manufacture carbohydrates from our bodies. That's what gluconeogenesis is. You can manufacture carbohydrates from fat. You can manufacture carbohydrates from protein. So if you didn't eat carbohydrates, your body would find a way to make them. That's what the ketogenic diet is about, that you eat a very low carbohydrate diet and then your body manufactures carbohydrates in the form of ketones. Ketones aren't exactly carbohydrates, but it manufactures ketones instead from your fat and you burn fat. And so is it necessarily addictive? Well, when you talk about the word addiction, it's a complex word. It has to do with the receptors that are being stimulated, the neurotransmitters that are being stimulated, and people have a psycho-spiritual feeling about the experiences they're having. There are people who are like, well, I can stop eating sugar anytime, and they do, and there's no problem there. And then there are other people who absolutely can because there's an emotional piece to it. You and I may experience the same neurotransmitter rush from consuming a bit of sugar, but if one person has a kind of will where they can tolerate the changes in their fluctuating sugar levels, they may be able to stop eating sugar, you know, have some sugar today and none tomorrow. And the other person just needs that change in their neurotransmitters and they can't stop. Some people, and that's what some people report, they have to stop eating sugar because if they eat any at all, they can't stop. I hesitate to say that sugar is addictive because whereas nicotine is something that if you never had it again, you'd be fine, you know, whereas your body needs glucose to function. And that's the most basic sugar. Your body needs glucose to function. If you had no glucose in your brain couldn't function. So to say you're addicted to a substance that you actually need is a little odd for me. Now, again, you can make glucose from protein in your body. You can make glucose from fat in your body. That there's gluconeogenesis. So, I don't know if you can actually make glucose from fat. You can make ketones from fat, which you can use as fuel. But you can make new glucose in your body. Your body is able to do that. So could you never eat it again? In our culture, in health, what you see is that most people don't do that. You don't see most people eating ketogenic diets. And I see people who are healthy who do not eat ketogenic diets. So what I have to think is that ketogenic diets are really best for people who ketogenic diets fit them. And it's likely that people who do well on ketogenic diets have a lot of insulin sensitivity. And so people genetically have different sensitivities to insulin. So if you have a tendency to be more insulin resistant, you're going to do better on a ketogenic diet. So people who are diabetic, especially type 2 diabetic, they do well on ketogenic diets. And if you manage your insulin well, you can do a ketogenic diet and be insulin dependent. And so those tend to be the people that do best on it. People who are very insulin sensitive, and if they're that insulin sensitive, they're very good at manufacturing ketones metabolically from their fat. But not everybody is like that. I'm probably not that way because I spent two weeks eating just protein and vegetables a few years back, and I felt terrible the whole time. My body's not efficient at manufacturing ketones, and I think most people's bodies are not efficient manufacturing ketones. And is that because our whole lives we've been fed starch and so our bodies have just evolved or just, you know, grown up that way? Or are there genetic differences? I like to think there are genetic differences. And so I don't like to say that sugars and starches are addictive because there are people who, if they don't eat any, they don't feel well. They're necessary to life. And then your body does use them for fuel and energy. It doesn't use them to make you sick. Having said that, there are problems with eating added sugars. So what are some problems with sugar? Of course, if you eat too much sugar and you are not managing your insulin well, you can get diabetes. And will most people get diabetes? I don't know if you have to have a genetic predisposition, or if anybody eats enough refined sugar, they're going to become pre-diabetic or you know, type 2 diabetic. I'm not sure about that. Certainly, if you have a genetic predisposition to diabetes, you're going to, and you eat too much sugar, you're going to manifest diabetes, which means that you're going to have excessively elevated blood sugar, and that your hemoglobin A1C, you're going to have damage to your red blood cells, and you'll have an elevated hemoglobin A1C, which means that there are cells in your body that are being damaged by glycation, the addition of sugar to various proteins in your body. So if you eat too much sugar, especially added sugars, you can become diabetic. And if you're not, I mean, if you're type 1 diabetic, that's usually brought on, but that's tends to be genetic, and that tends to be brought on by a stressor, or you're born that way, or you find out you're type 1 diabetic at a very young age. And type 1 diabetic means that you no longer have the ability to produce insulin from your pancreatic islet cells, and insulin being the compound that drives sugar into your cells for use. Insulin is also a manager of inflammatory compounds and growth compounds like insulin-like growth factor. And it also is a traffic director. If you don't consume all the sugar and starches that are in your blood, your insulin is going to direct those sugars to be converted into fat in the form of triglycerides. And then eventually those triglycerides are going to be stored in your fat cells. So if you eat too much sugar, at the other end of the spectrum, you could become diabetic. Then there's some basic things that happen with sugar. Sugar causes acne. How does sugar cause acne? Is this something that's been proven? Well, in my experience, yeah, it makes sense that it would cause acne, simply because when you eat sugar, you raise your insulin. There are people whose sebaceous glands are more sensitive to androgens. And when you increase insulin, you increase androgens. You have more androgens around. Those androgens are so-called male hormones like testosterone, DHEA, androstenedione. And if those hormones bond to your sebaceous glands, you make more oil. You make more oil, the bacteria on your skin goes yum, 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 starts eating it. And then you have an overgrowth of bacteria on your skin, and your immune system goes, no, you can't be here. And your immune system goes after those the bacteria that are eating the oil on your skin. And now you have an inflammatory spot in a sebaceous gland. It's called a comedone, or a pimple, or a blemish. So that's a way that you get acne. So some people find that if they reduce, so any kind of inflammation in your body can increase your insulin. So certainly eating sugar can do that. And that's why people think, oh, chocolate causes acne. Well, it's probably not the chocolate, it's the sugar, right? And that makes sense, that it wouldn't matter if it was chocolate or if it was a pastry that didn't have any chocolate in it. Because I propose that unless you have an allergy to cocoa, that makes your inflammation go up. So if you haven't, that would be how chocolate would cause acne, if you had a specific inflammatory response to chocolate itself. That's hard to tease out because most people don't eat chocolate without eating sugar with it. It is possible to do because you can eat cacao nibs. Those are available. You can sprinkle them on your on a fruit salad. You can sprinkle them into a salad. You can eat them with yogurt. You can eat them as a snack on their own and eat them unsweetened. So that's a way to eat unsweetened chocolate. But people tend to eat chocolate with sugar in it. So it's hard to know if it's the chocolate or the sugar unless you separate them out. And so it makes sense that eating more sugar would increase your acne because eating more sugar increases your insulin, And as I said, when you have an increased insulin, you have increased androgens. The androgens then go and stimulate the sebaceous glands, and then you get more acne, and that produces an immune response, which produces acne. And I have to tell you that my young, it's mostly younger patients who come in their teens and 20s, who come in with acne, and they do not like it. And I feel like I need to have more compassion for them because I'm very blessed with, acne wasn't a big deal for me. When I was a teenager, I would get into my 20s, I would get an occasional blemish. Mm. I would, you know, I might do warm compresses on it, or I might, put some tea tree oil on it, but it wasn't a big deal for me. But people who have acne, it really bothers them. It's upsetting. I mean, when you have these little dots all over these little oily dots all over your face, it's upsetting, and you can understand that. And so I have to talk to them about what they eat and what they put on their face. And by the way, acne is an internal event. It is not it's not just something you treat topically, although you can treat it topically because, you know, in the beauty industry, we love to put stuff on our faces and we love to put stuff on our bodies. And putting stuff on your body has been something we've done since ancient times. So I'm all for health and beauty aid products, whether natural or I'm not crazy about stuff that's not natural, but I certainly use lotions and creams and body wash and shampoo and all kinds of stuff like that. And it's enjoyable. People have loved to do beautification routines for thousands of years. So I'm all for that. So if you treat your acne topically, that's one of the things that you can do. You know, washing your face. We go into the environment. You're in the world. The world has some pollution in it. There's going to be probably some hydrocarbons that you're exposed to, especially if you live in a city where there's pollution. That's not going to be good for your skin. So if you wash your face and then you moisturize with a nice moisturizer, that's going to be helpful for you. And, you know, if you go out in the sun, you get oxidative damage from the sun. And so, you know, doing things to help your face in that way is fine. And then if you want to do things that are astringent, if you have excess oil on your face and you want to use astringents like witch hazel or other kinds of facial toners or even benzoyl peroxide if you have to, you can do that. But remember that the source of acne is internal. It's an inflammatory event that's happening inside your body, and that the way that you improve acne is to improve your digestion, improve your diet, and reduce inflammation in your body. And guess what? Reduce stress. Acne will be aggravated by stress because guess what? If you have too much stress, you have too much cortisol. What does cortisol do? Dump sugar into your blood. Dump sugar into your blood, increases the insulin. Insulin increases the androgen, and off we go again, right? So reducing stress can help your acne, believe it or not. All right. So there's the, so that's sugar, another thing, sugar. Sugar slows down the functioning of white blood cells and therefore your immune system. So you'll likely do worse with respiratory conditions. So this is the other thing that happens. You get Halloween, and I used to hear, we naturopaths and also pediatricians talking about that you have a boom the week after Halloween because all the kids get sick because they've eaten a whole bunch of candy. And now, of course, we have the triple-demic, and I'm just wondering how bad the triple-demic is, because it's certainly the news media really wants you to think the triple-demic is very bad because it's being really, really pushed hard.
God, it's ridiculous.
Yes, and the triple-demic being COVID-19, that COVID-19 infections are up a countrywide about 7% over a few weeks ago. I'm not sure what the timing is on that. But COVID-19 infections are up. I'm definitely hearing about patients and friends catching COVID. And the good news is that when people are catching COVID, now this doesn't mean go out and catch COVID and go out and, you know, be cavalier about catching COVID. People are doing better with it. You know, that people, they get sick, they're able to stay home, and they're over it in a week's time or so. Doesn't mean it's a good idea for you to try and get it, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't be concerned and try to prevent it. I still think it's a good idea to use your neti pot and silver hydrosol and gargle and don't eat too much sugar, get your rest, and take care of yourself. And if you're going to go out, if you're really concerned about catching stuff, if you're going to go out in a place where there's a lot of people, wear a mask. Masks still work, even though nobody wants to wear them anymore. They still work. And, you know, if Ron and I go into, if we go into a place where there's a lot of people, like when you go to the basketball games, you're wearing a mask, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. So, because I know people who have, that's how they caught their COVID. They
went to a sporting event. And there are people there that aren't. And then there are people that are.
Right.
So it's kind of a mix. I would say it's more not than are.
Right. Well, people are done with masks. I mean, I'm kind of done with masks. I just wear them anyway. So, and I understand being done with masks. They're not comfortable. They're not fun. And they can be hot and they can be confining. And if you tend to, you tend to sweat a lot, or you tend to have any kind of lightheadedness issues or hydration issues, they can be difficult. Speaking of hydration issues.
Yeah. Don't forget the drink.
Especially because I'm moving my workouts indoors and, you know, going from working out outdoors where you don't sweat as much to all of a sudden working out indoors where you do sweat a lot, and you have to get used to making sure to hydrate extra for that. I actually had blood work done last week and my sodium was low.
Really?
Yeah. My sodium was a little low. And I told Amy, my office manager, I said, oh, look at that. My sodium is a little low. She said, oh, that's exciting. That means you get to eat more salt. And that was both of our reactions. We didn't go, oh no, your sodium. It was only a point out of range. But that was both of our reactions. Oh boy, I get to eat more salt. So, I mean, not that I don't eat salt. I do put good, because I don't eat a lot of processed food. I do add salt to my salad. That is why a salt, you know, the Spanish word for salt is ensalada. And I guess in Italian it's insalat. Ensalada means it's got salt on it. It's a salted thing. So I bet you didn't know that. So, like, salada means it has salt on it.
So what does salada tea mean?
That's, I don't know. I mean, salada in Spanish means salted. So
it's not salty. It's tea.
No, I know. I don't.
I mean, it doesn't taste good.
Maybe it was somebody's name. I don't know. I've thought of that when I learned about, you know, in Spanish, the word for salad is ensalada. And of course, we thought about salada tea. It's probably somebody's name. I, you know, they came from a salty, they came from a seaside place. So they called it, so they were called salada. I don't know. But sugar does slow down the functioning of your immune system. And if you are around a lot of sick people and you eat a lot of sugar, that's why another reason people get sick this time of year, because all the treats starts with October. The eating season has officially begun and starts with the candy. I see this one sitting on the couch munching on M&Ms and different kinds of candy and
it's
stuff.
October.
I know. And we have to be careful about that, because it does slow down the functioning of your immune system and your white blood cells.
Ooh.
And you're more likely to get sick if you eat a lot of candy.
No.
One of the problems with sugar is it makes you gain weight. We talked about this already. You store what you don't burn as fat, and you increase your serum insulin. So so you wind up getting into a sugar situation. And again, it's this idea of your body needs glucose to function. It needs glucose, or at least it needs ketones. But ultimately, your brain needs glucose to run. And a lot of the functions in your body need glucose to function. And so, if you, whether you eat it or you manufacture it anew, you need it to function. So the thing is, if you eat sugar, and especially if you eat sugar to excess, your body's going to be lazy, because it's not going to burn any fat, because it's got this ready source of sugar that you just put into your blood. So it's going to use that preferentially, and it's not going to dip into your fat stores. So now if you eat, if you're at a weight that where you're happy and healthy, and you can find an equilibrium where you eat an amount of sugar that makes you happy and healthy and you don't gain any weight, then that's great. But you have to remember all the other health issues. Just because you're at a good weight doesn't mean you don't have acne, and doesn't mean you have swings in your blood sugar, and that can cause mood changes. So the issue is that it will make you, it tends to make you gain weight the more you eat, and because Your body uses it immediately as an immediate, easy source of fuel and isn't going to dip into your cells. And you store what you don't burn as fat, and then your insulin goes up. Once your insulin goes up, if you have the more insulin you have around, you're going to tend to be more hypoglycemic, because what insulin does is it sees the sugar in your blood and it pulls the sugar out of your blood if it can get it into your cells. And then you're going to have more swings in your blood sugar. Your goal for your insulin is you want your insulin to be nice and even. You want to use your insulin sparingly. And so you want to eat things that don't raise your insulin too much, so you're not pulling sugar out of your blood rapidly. And if you suddenly eat something that's very sweet, your insulin's going to come out like gangbusters and pull it out of your blood. And then you're going to be hypoglycemic and you're going to be hungry again. And then you get into this cycle. So if you eat fat, if you eat good quality fat, like, you know, MCT oil or coconut oil or olive oil, or I'm going to get myself some Sacha Inchi oil. I'm so excited. It's coming in the mail. Yeah, it's really good stuff. Sacha Inchi, I'll talk about Sacha Inchi at another time.
It's amazing what excites you.
Sacha Inchi's good. They're really, really nice. I forgot about them, and then I don't know. I started thinking about them and said, you know, I'm going to get some Sacha Inchi seeds. Sacha Inchi seeds are often part of vegan protein powders and stuff, because they're really, I can talk about Sacha Inchi seeds another time. Okay, so it can cause weight gain because it makes your body, it gives a ready source of fuel so that your body doesn't dip into your fat stores, and what you don't use, you will continue to store, because you're going to have more insulin around that's going to make you more likely to store that fat. We already talked about if you're prone to it, you can become diabetic if you eat too much. So I have some other things to think about when we talk about sugar. Let's see. So here's, I have a list of, somebody wrote an article about why sugar is too bad, too much sugar is bad for you. And a lot of things we already talked about. The other thing is it can increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease is associated with high sugar diets. So why might that be? It's because if you have more insulin around, again, that increases the inflammatory compounds in your blood. And when you have more inflammation, more inflammatory compounds in your blood, it can cause inflammation to the inside of the blood vessels, which your body then has to repair. And what does it repair? Damaged blood vessels with calcium, platelets, and cholesterol. That can lead to atherosclerosis, and that tends to happen in people who are prone to it, but I think some degree of it can happen in anybody. And so once you have elevated triglycerides are the form of fat that is flowing through your blood, and if your insulin can't drive the sugar that you've eaten into your cells, it's going to first turn it into triglycerides, and then the triglycerides are also going to be stored as fat. If high triglycerides are not stable. Triglycerides are easily oxidized. So once they get oxidized, they can run around the inside of your blood vessels and cause damage. Damaged inside of the blood vessels, that leads to atherosclerosis. So consuming too much sugar, especially from sugar sweetened drinks, has been linked directly to atherosclerosis. And there was a study of over 25,000 people who consumed more added sugar. They had a greater risk of developing heart disease and coronary complications compared to individuals who add less sugar. Sugar intake increases cardiovascular risk, but also increases stroke risk, just because, like I said, it's going to cause damage to blood vessels anywhere in your body. So more than 8 servings a week of sugar sweetened beverages were associated with increased stroke risk. So when I say sugar sweetened beverages, they're mostly talking about soda. And when you say a serving, you're probably talking about 8 ounces of soda. So if you're drinking less than 8 ounces of soda a week, when you're talking about sugar sweetened beverages, you're talking about soda. You're talking about that sweet drink you got at the drive-through coffee place or whatever coffee place, and you're talking about any other sugar sweetened beverage. So if you're drinking too much sport drink that has a lot of sugar in it, and you're not burning it off. If you're drinking, say, chocolate milk and you're drinking a lot of it, you know, 8 ounces every single day, that could be an issue. So watching your sugar sweetened beverages specifically, because sugar sweetened beverages, they're just a real easy way to get a lot of sugar in all at once. And so did you know that a 12-ounce can of soda has 39 grams of sugar? And that's 8% of your total calorie consumption. So one sugary drink a day can bring you close to your recommended daily limit for added sugar. So you might want to consider, if you want something sweet in a day, do you really want to waste it on a big old can of soda? In this article, it talks about how sugar is linked to acne, which we already discussed, and increases the risk of type 2 diabetes. Sugar may increase your risk of cancer. If you eat too much sugar, you can increase your risk of developing certain cancers. Of course, you'll gain weight, and obesity can increase your risk of certain kinds of cancer. Of course, it increases inflammation in general. So the issue is, when you have too much inflammation in your body, what can happen is that you can damage cells, and you can damage the DNA of your cells. And if you damage that DNA, damaged DNA can lead to unhealthy cells, which can lead to cancer. And so there are some studies that found that sugar leads to certain kinds of cancer. Too much sugar can lead to a greater risk of prostate cancer, also esophageal cancer, and, esophageal cancer is rare. I mean, and you're more likely to get esophageal cancer. You know who gets esophageal cancer? People who are alcoholics, unfortunately, people who drink a lot of alcohol, because alcohol also causes oxidative damage to tissues. And any surface, the thing with alcohol is any surface that the alcohol touches can be damaged by it. So if you're drinking alcohol, you can get lip cancer, oral cancer, tongue cancer, throat cancer, esophageal cancer, stomach cancer. I'm not going to say if you're having one glass of wine every couple of days that that's going to happen to you in the context of a healthy diet. I'm talking about people who are drinking to excess, more than two or three drinks every single day, are binge drinkers. But also the esophageal cancer is associated with increased consumption of table sugar and sweetened desserts and beverages. And what I'm surprised is this doesn't say anything about pancreatic cancer. I'm not sure if that increases your risk. Cancer is going to happen. You tend to have a predisposition to cancer, but sugar is going to increase your chances of manifesting that cancer because of the oxidative stress it causes. Sugar can affect your mood. It can make you depressed. And it can cause cognitive impairment, memory problems, emotional disorders, can increase anxiety and depression. So again, systemic inflammation can affect your brain. It can affect your nerves. It can affect your dopaminergic signaling. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter that makes you happy. And if you affect your dopaminergic nerves, you're not going to feel as happy. And you know that drug Wellbutrin that a lot of people take, Wellbutrin, which is the generic term is bupropion. Bupropion increases dopamine. And so bupropion is something that's used. Wellbutrin is what they give you when you have depression. They give you Zyban if you're trying to quit smoking. And Zyban is the exact same drug as Wellbutrin. So it's something that increases your dopamine so that you're less likely to have the emotional piece of wanting to smoke. So you can get depressed from having too much sugar, again, because of the increased inflammation and because sugar affects your dopamine and serotonin signaling, when you have sugar, your blood sugar, your insulin goes up and down at a more drastic rate than if you don't have it. And that interacts with your hypothalamic pituitary axis, and your cortisol and your energy, and it affects your mood ultimately. And so there was actually a study in over 69,000 women that showed that those with the highest sugar intake had a significantly greater risk of depression compared with those with the lowest intakes. Also, it can give you wrinkles. So how does it give you wrinkles? Same way as it does to everything else. It you get glycation. Glycation is where you have sugar attaching to proteins. So when you have proteins are like soft and supple and smooth. And when sugar attaches to them, they become brittle. So if you have sugar attaching to the cells in your skin, then it's going to give you more wrinkles. So eating a lot of sugar can actually increase your aging process. It can give you more wrinkles. Can you offset that by using, nice face creams and stuff? Probably to some extent, but higher carbohydrate diets aren't as good for you as diets that are lower in refined carbohydrates and sugar. The advanced glycation end products, these glycated proteins, damage your collagen and elastin, which helps your skin feel nice and stretchy. So that's interesting. And it can sugar can increase the aging of your actual cells. So it can shorten your telomeres. So telomeres are, how you have on shoelaces, you have those little end caps. Those are little end caps to protect the shoelace from unraveling. Well, you have those on your chromosomes, and they're called telomeres. The longer your telomeres are, the more protected your chromosomes are. And if you eat sugar, your telomeres get shorter and they get damaged. As you get older, your telomeres shorten, which means that your cells are starting to age and malfunction. Shortening your telomeres is a natural part of aging, but there are certain lifestyle choices that can increase your shortening of your telomeres. When you eat a healthy diet and you get regular exercise and you get good sleep and all that, you maintain the length of your telomeres. And people who tend to look younger at more advanced ages, they tend to have longer telomeres because their cells are protected from aging. So sugar can make you tired. So if you're tired a lot, you may be eating too much starch and sugar. And you feel like, if you eat a carbohydrate, you're going to have an increase in energy, but it's going to increase your energy quickly and then it's going to drop off. And it has to do, once again, with the efficiency of your body using sugars for energy. That if you eat a lower carbohydrate diet or if your carbohydrates are slow acting and you have a slower rise in your blood sugar by eating protein, by eating fiber, by eating healthy fat, then you're going to have better energy. So if you're going to have a carbohydrate, you might want to have some fat or protein with it. So like apples with almond butter is a good choice in that sense. You can get fatty liver from eating too much sugar. So you're going to get fatty replacement because your liver is so overwhelmed with taking care of the sugar that's in your system that you're going to get extra fat storage and fatty replacement of your liver cells because of damage to your liver cells. There you can also increase your kidney disease risk, obviously affect your dental health. It can increase your risk of gout, having too much uric acid and stones from that, and cognitive decline. So those are all problems with eating too much sugar. I have to go. It's time to go. So all about sugar, we're going to probably talk a little bit more about different kinds of sugars and their benefits and detriments next week, along with some stuff about Thanksgiving. But I'm going to sign off now. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch-ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.